This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. I'm so excited that my guest today is Ricky Kleeman, who wrote a book called Fairy Tales Can Come True, How a Driven Woman Changed Her Destiny.
Can come true, it can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart.
Hi, Ricky.
Hey, Patsy.
Well, I was just playing Fairy Tales Can Come True. And I, your book is so inspirational, and I know it has inspired so many women. So it's very exciting to have you on my program today.
I'm thrilled to be with you.
Well, you know, in a way, it's like talking to an old friend, because your book is really so intimate and so candid that you really talked about yourself in a way that one feels one knows you.
Well, I appreciate that. I know it's been said by certain people that perhaps it's a bit too candid, but nonetheless, I think that if your purpose in writing a book is to give inspiration to women, then you really cannot afford to have guile, that you have to show that no matter what successes you may have achieved in any sphere, that you also have made mistakes, that you were also vulnerable, that there were things in your life that perhaps the public didn't see, but that really made you have aches of the heart and of the head, let alone of the body. And I think that so many women, whether they were 22 or 82, who read this book over time and who took the time in their lives to let me know that it had served a purpose for them, that there's really universality in detail, that somehow people will find something that they can identify with. And it doesn't matter if you're a lawyer or a television person like me, or if you're a stay-at-home mom, or if you're a nurse or a social worker or a doctor, or you're an entrepreneur, that there are things in that book that every woman, I think, says, well, yeah, I felt just like that.
That's true. You know, you're such an accomplished woman. You've done so many things. Of course, you were, when you were practicing law, you were voted one of the top five women lawyers by Time magazine. And of course, you were the anchor on Court TV during one of the most important times in history, during the OJ trial and I think the Clinton administration. So you really got out there and people got to know you. And so it was, did you enjoy that process of being on Court TV?
Well, I think Court TV was clearly one of the greatest jobs of my life. I used to say that I was going to stay at Court TV should it have continued in existence until the drool was dripping down my face at some ancient old age. I was blessed in getting that job. They had covered some of my cases over time when I was practicing law full-time. When I first went down to Court TV to appear as a guest commentator, I had never seen Court TV. It wasn't on my cable system at that point. And it was a small network, which eventually grew to hundreds of thousands of subscribers. And I think at various points in time that what we found was that we could have a moment in time for a verdict where you could have 2 million viewers, and for a cable network, that was an extraordinary number. I would say that job and the job I have now as a legal analyst for CBS News are definitely my two most favorite jobs of my life. And when I look at the time differential, I started at Court TV. I was hired specifically to cover the Simpson case. I started at Court TV in the fall of 1994. I thought I would stay about 6 months. I wound up staying for 15 years. They were great years. It was being at moments of history. I mean, you mentioned two of them. One certainly was for people of my generation, of where were you at the time that either the Bronco chase went on, or where were you at the time of the OJ verdict? And then eventually the good fortune I had to be co-hosting with Johnny Cochran in a show called Cochran and Company. I was company. That we were there during the entire Bill Clinton grand jury and impeachment proceedings, or as has been called, the year of Monica Lewinsky. Hard to beat that kind of a job when you wanted in your life first to be an actress and later to be a trial lawyer and also to be a teacher. So the three occupations that moved me all rolled into one when I became a Court TV anchor. So the job that had my name on it, and I just thank my lucky stars that I was in the right place at the right time and had worked hard enough to be in that place.
One of the reasons your book is so fascinating is you do cover all of that. But I want to go back from and just to the title, Fairy Tales Can Come True. And that brings us to a very, very important part of your life. I know that I fell in love with my husband the moment I saw him, and it was like a flash for me. How was it on the day that you first met your husband, Bill Bratton?
Well, my husband, Bill Bratton, who is the police commissioner of the city of New York now, we met actually twice. So we have two very different reactions to that. The first time we met, which is why it was meant for a book, I was representing an infamous fugitive, a woman named Catherine Ann Power, who had been out in the cold for 23 years. And I surrendered her at dawn in the parking lot of the Boston College Law School to Bill as police commissioner in Boston and the FBI. And Bill and I were married to two other people. I remember thinking that, yes, indeed, he was the most charismatic person I had met. But it wasn't like a blip on my screen or vice versa. It was just an appreciation. I had read about him for 15 years. I had an appreciation of the person that he was and the leader that he was. And he certainly has that indefinable something that when he walks into a room, everybody looks up. And then we didn't see each other until about 5 years later when we re-met in New York, which is your story, you know, it's the love at first sight story. Our circumstances had dramatically changed personally. We were both living in a different city. And I was at a breakfast with my new boss at Court TV. Bill was sitting at another table with a gentleman. And when I was exiting, I thought I'd get a brownie point with a new boss. So I said, would you like to meet Police Commissioner Bratton? And he said, oh, of course, you'd know him from Boston. So 5 years later, we go up to see Bill at 8:15 in the morning. We exchange a business card, a kiss on the cheek. And he says at 8:15, you look so beautiful. If you were single, I would marry you. So that was a declaration of intention. And I said, well, perhaps you should call me for lunch. And when I got in the car with the new boss, he said, you know he's going to call you. And I said, don't be ridiculous. I said, who would say something like that at 8:15 in the morning? And sure enough, by the time I got to work, he had called and left a voicemail. So, and the rest of that was galloping into that fairy tale. I have often thought about fate or serendipity, that I was meant to have been in that restaurant at that moment, because if you haven't run into someone in 5 years, we had both been in New York. It was just meant to be.
Well, you know,
and go ahead.
I agree with you. I think life is sort of like a magic tapestry. You know, we all these different threads run through our life, and then sometimes they just meet up and weave such a beautiful pattern. And that's how, you know, I felt with my husband, and I know that you feel with yours, that it was meant to be. It was meant to weave this beautiful, beautiful tapestry.
Well, we're very blessed. We were older. We had obviously been through marriages in the past, and we were ready. And I think that you had two pretty driven people, who, as I've often described it, would be like we were on two parallel runways. We would have never connected. And we were both at a point in our life for very different reasons where I think that we were ready for this kind of commitment. And we're now together, I guess it's about 18 years, married 16 years, and we are probably happier today than we've ever been, and we started out at a pretty high level. And I think for your listeners, one of the things that I really believe about making relationships work is that each person has to take 100% responsibility for the relationship, not 50%. And if each person takes 100% responsibility to this commitment, that you are willing to go through the ebbs and flows, because the commitment and the relationship is what is paramount. And as I, you know, grow much older, I'm conscious of the fact that I'd much rather come home to my husband at night than come home to a file that I'd have to study the next day and think that was my companion. Not to say we don't both work extraordinarily hard. We are both really busy people, but we really make time for one another.
And you have to set your priorities. What's important in life?
And what's important in life changes with your age and changes with your circumstances. I do think, I talk to lots of young women often, and serve on a mentoring council at my university. So I'm talking a lot to women between the ages of 18 and 22. And on the other side of that, I talk to a lot of women who are retired or having new careers after the age of 55 or 65, and talk to them about achieving a life of significance, talk to young people about magnificent motivation. And there are different times for different priorities, because we can't be excellent at everything all at the same time. It's impossible. So my favorite question with young collegiate women is, or comment and question is, I want to have a family, and I want to have this career, and so I'm now, you know, 19, 20, 21, so I'm not going to get married, and I'm not going to have a child until I'm 30, and that's when I'm going to do it. Well, who knows what your life is going to look like when you're 30, and who knows if the right person is going to come along. We don't yet live in a technological society where we go to a corner store and open a cabinet and pick out a child. We have to go through a process of conceiving that child. And I think that young women today often think that they can time it all out just like they do their Outlook calendar. Well, it doesn't quite work that way.
No, that's true. You never know what's going to happen to you. It's like I had never expected, I had never even thought about a radio program until, well, in a way, partly because of you. I was one morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, I said, I want to do a radio program. Now, there was I didn't have a background other than speaking at Hadassah meetings. I was not a public speaker. I'm a writer. But when I decided to do it, I said, I can do it. You know, if so-and-so, you know, Megyn Kelly can do her television program, or, and you could do all that you did, and you know, some other women who I thought about, I said, I can do it. And it was really quite amazing that when you make that decision, you know, like within a month, I was on the radio and doing what I really love to do, is talk to interesting people. So I want to inspire writers, particularly. I work with a lot of writers to get out there and you know, people start a book and they don't finish it, or they're afraid that it has to be perfect. And I tell them it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be done.
Well, that's really a good piece of advice. You know, I talk a great deal about the fact that the quest for perfection is a quest doomed for failure. There is a chapter in my book called The Perils of Being Perfect, that you really cannot be perfect. Superman is a fictional character, and so is Superwoman. And the point is to finish. I think that's a great piece of advice. The idea of whatever the job is, whatever the creative venture is, whatever the task is the beginning, middle, and end, and a goal of completion. That I like to use metaphors from sports, because I think they're so easy to understand. The idea, if you're running a race, a 10K race or a 5K race, or you're walking in a race, whatever it happens to be, the important thing is to finish. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to finish first. It just means you have to finish. And I think that's a big lesson in maturity, a big lesson. I could have never thought that way or felt that way when I was in my 20s and 30s, where I had this quest to be the best or the first. I can go back to being in grammar school, where elementary school, where we had these math problems in the fourth grade, and as soon as you would get an assignment in class, and you would have to do this work page, and as soon as you finished, you raised your hand, and you got a number. So if there were 40 students in the class, someone was number one and someone was 40, and then we exchanged papers and graded them, and then you got another number for how many you got wrong. So the best score would be one. You finished first, and you got zero wrong. Well, can you think of the traumatizing of young people that this exercise did? I mean, I look back upon that. I remember a day in the fourth grade, I can see that workbook, where I was really having problems doing big multiplication. That is, you know, 12,868 times 11,203, or whatever it would happen to be. And I could see I was slow. I just was not fast. And I got so nervous that I would be number 40 in the class, or whatever the number would have been. I don't remember how many people were in the class, that I actually made myself sick enough that I had to be excused to go throw up. Now, that's really a young, be perfect driver. And that episode has always stayed with me as a lesson that completion is the goal, not being first. Because the fact that you'd make yourself sick enough so you wouldn't be embarrassed, or with other people, you give up. The important thing, it's Winston Churchill's speech, when he went to give this great speech when he was an extraordinary orator, and he got up and everyone expected him to go on for hours, and his speech was, never give up, never give up, never give up. Or as other historians have said his speech was never give in, never give in, never give in. But whichever was the final word, the reality is that you can take a major project like a book or an article, and you can break it into small steps so that you can ultimately finish. And is it perfect? No, of course not. Have we ever read a perfect book? I doubt it.
And it's there's no sense making yourself sick about it. That's the lesson I think you have to learn. Just do it and take pleasure in the doing and not in trying to be perfect.
Now, exactly right.
Now, your life has come sort of around full circle because you started off as a little girl wanting to be an actress. And I know that you've done some acting in television shows, and you most recently, I think, was Blue Bloods. You were on, that's my favorite television show.
It's a great TV show, isn't it? I love those family scenes when they sit around the table. I mean, it's just such a delight.
Absolutely. It's so great. And so what was it like? I mean, here you are with the most famous police commissioner on television and the most famous police commissioner in real life. They should bring you back as a running character, you know, maybe the love interest of Tom Selleck in that show, huh?
Well, listen, that would be good fun. Tom Selleck is terrific. I first met him actually back in Los Angeles. I had played a lawyer in an NBC series called Las Vegas, and it was a casino and hotel, and Jimmy Kahn was the manager, owner. So I was Jimmy Kahn's lawyer for 4 years, and I would do about 4 episodes a year, and the character was actually based on me. And so there were times where it was challenging because sometimes the character didn't exactly speak like I would speak. So it was definitely using a memory muscle to learn lines that I might not say exactly that way. So at some point, Jimmy left the show, and the last year of the show, that is in the time that I was on it, Tom Selleck took over. He came in as the new casino owner. And so I had the good fortune of doing an episode with him back in Los Angeles. And he was so professional. And just if you did good work, if you were competent, he liked you. If you were someone who wasn't up to snuff for him because he's so professional, you knew it. So years passed. And when they were putting together the show Blue Bloods, the executive producer of Blue Bloods had suggested to Tom Selleck that he should read Bill Bratton's book, which is called Turnaround, the first book that Bill did back, actually before Bill and I were together. I think came out about January of 98. And Tom became a big student of my husband's, and we eventually all got together for dinner with Tom Selleck and the executive producer wanting to know about things that were accurate and things that weren't accurate. And my husband gave Tom Selleck a pin, which he actually wears from time to time on the show on his suits. So we've always really enjoyed him as a person. So when I got the opportunity, this is my second appearance. I did one last year and one this year, of playing this nasty, really irascible judge. As my husband says, he says, boy, I really don't want to be married to that woman. So I've had a lot of fun in that show, and I actually have not done the scene with Tom. I did one with Donnie Wahlberg. He was terrific. And then the last one I did was with Bridget Moynihan, who is one of the loveliest women I have ever met. Just lovely.
Well, we hope to see you back on that show. Now, it was very lucky in a way. I know that your husband was offered the role of head of the Metropolitan Police in London, like the head of
not quite.
Well,
not quite.
Something like that.
I still have a bag pack.
Yeah, Scotland Yard.
If my memory is correct, I think it is. It was August of 2011 Prime Minister Cameron was speaking at the House of Commons, and it was during the time of the hacking scandal, the newspaper hacking scandal, and then the scandal spread to Scotland Yard that you had had these higher-ups at Scotland Yard who had been living hand-in-glove with these reporters and supplying them with information, and it was really a terrible scandal. So Prime Minister Cameron was speaking, and it was televised, and it was, as I recall, we saw it on CNN, that he put out what I would call a trial balloon about looking for new blood, if you will, these are my words, to head New Scotland Yard, the Metropolitan Police, and that, in essence, it wouldn't be a bad thing if you went across the pond to someone who really had shown their leadership qualities and was innovative and et cetera. Well, Prime Minister Cameron had met with my husband prior to that, and it was known that he had, and Bill had advised him about various things about crime and disorder. And Bill had been given the award or status, if you will, of an CBE, which is a commander of the British Empire. That is the highest honor you can receive if you are not a British citizen. If you're a British citizen, you could be knighted. So it went like wildfire that obviously Prime Minister Cameron must be referring to Bill Bratton. And there was a big brouhaha in the press, and I really thought it would have been fantastic.
It would have been fun. I lived in England for quite a few years, and it would have been lots of fun. But London's loss was New York's gain. And while, before I have to let you go, and, you know, I'll tell you something. I was supposed to take a break at some point, but I just didn't want to take a break. So, but before I let you go, I wanted just to ask you a little bit about your documentary, which I know has meant so much to you, In the Line of Fire.
Thank you for asking. I had wanted to do this for quite some time, I mean years. It is a documentary that was done for Investigation Discovery Network. It originally aired on Sunday, May 17th, and has re-aired, and I'm sure will re-air again. And probably there are ways to get it on the internet and on YouTube. And it is it's the stories of three police officers on New York, L.A., and just outside of Minneapolis, St. Paul, a place called Maplewood. And it is three police officers who are real heroes. And they did, in their normal course of their duty on a regular day, they wound up doing extraordinary things in saving other people's lives.
And where is this going to air? Where is it going?
Investigation Discovery Network, which you can look at as ID on your cable network. Uh-huh. And you can find out about it on ID. And it's aired, as I say, now a few times on ID. And it's something I'm really proud of as part of the dialogue. I mean, we do hear about these terrible events involving bad police officers, and we also ought to remember that every day police officers risk their lives for others. And if I never do another one, I will still say I really made a contribution by doing this one. I'm very proud of it, and I hope I do more.
Well, you and your husband both make such a major contribution to New York and to to this very during this very difficult time for law enforcement. And I know all of our prayers are always with your husband, who has done such marvelous work of reducing crime, first in Boston, Los Angeles, and back in New York. And it's just, I know he has to be under constant stress, and it's so great to know that he's got you there to take care of him, and to the two of you can keep it all centered and find the joy in life, and that's important.
Well, it really is important, and as I say, we're very blessed, but we also work hard at it.
Well, I'm very grateful to you for coming on my show today. I know that you're an inspiration to so many people, and I will always keep you in mind when I think of myself doing this program and finding the same kind of determination that you found throughout your life. And I hope that you're going to have your last book ended when you were on your way to Los Angeles. But I think you have to come out with a new book, like Living the Fairy Tale. And
well, I would love to do it. And I'll tell your listeners, too, that the basic way to get fairy tales now is on Kindle. It's challenging to get it in print anywhere.
Yes, I was going to tell people they have to get it on Kindle now. And I hope that you come out with a new book soon, and then you can come back on the program.
Well, I would love to talk to you. You're a complete delight, Pastor.
Oh, thank you so much, Ricky. It's just, this is for me, a fairy tale coming true to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Well, you've made my day, so thank you so much.
Okay.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Just play my music. This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Jody Hedlund. Hi, Jody, are you there?
I am, Patsy.
And you're up in Michigan, my favorite state. No, it's still I'm in Florida, but I have to admit, you know, I am from the Upper Peninsula.
Oh,
I'm a youper, a real youper. I'm no longer a snowbird. I'm down here in Florida permanently, but my heart is always in the Upper Peninsula.
It's a beautiful place.
So, I don't know where to start with you. You are so amazing. Do you have five kids, you homeschool them. In your spare time, you're a prolific writer. And you have one of the very, very best writer's webpage I have ever seen.
Oh, thank you.
I just had my guest before you was Ricky Kleeman, who wrote The Fairy Tales Can Come True. And so it was funny that I was following up with you, which your book, and your most recent book, The An Uncertain Choice, looks like, it's a fairy tale. The cover is beautifully done.
Absolutely.
With this fairy tale castle and beautiful Rosemary on the cover. Wonderful choice for a cover.
Mm-hmm. I love it. It's my favorite.
All of your covers are beautiful, but this is particularly, and it really sort of sets the tone for the story. So do you want to tell us a little bit about An Uncertain Choice and how you came up with the idea?
Yeah, sure. I have been writing adult fiction for quite a while. I have published numerous stories kind of inspired by real people from the past, and have been doing that for a number of years with Bethany House Publishers. But this past year, I've had the privilege of being able to work with Zondervan Publishers in releasing my first young adult novel.
And they are great. They are one of the best publishing houses around.
Yes. Yes, they're now associated with HarperCollins, and they are just wonderful. And so, yes, An Uncertain Choice is a medieval fairy tale-like story, and it's a series, and I'm really excited about it. As you said, I have five children, three of whom are now teens, and so I've become much more interested in in young adult novels and realized that as a parent, it's often really tough to know what I'm giving my teens as far as books. When we go to the library or buy books, it's really hard to know what content we're getting when we open the book up and start reading it. And sometimes as a parent, a more conservative parent, I feel like I'm playing a game of roulette every time I hand a book to my teens, because I never know what the level of sexual content is going to be between the covers. And like most parents, I just don't have time to read everything that I hand to my teens and in order to discuss the issues that might crop up. And so I really began to see a need for developing more clean romances for teen readers, and especially wanted to have a tool that I could give to my daughters to discuss and prepare them for dating. And so in light of all of that, I decided to write a book that models the purity and nobility and courtly love that existed in the days of old, in the times of knights and castles and their ladies. And so developed An Uncertain Choice, and it recently released in March and has been very widely loved and accepted so far, which is very exciting for me to see that there are a lot of teens out there who really love a clean read and enjoy chivalry and knights and castles and all of that. So that's kind of the behind the scenes of how I got started writing young adult.
And, well, you do more than just write the book. You actually go further and you write a companion piece, a discussion piece, which I think is so great. It really opens up a discussion, a dialogue that
right.
I haven't seen that done very often, and you are particularly, you know, you're great at it. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I did want to, like I said, provide a tool to young girls who are starting to think of dating, and not only for them, but also for their parents or their youth leaders or just their mentors. And so I do have, it is quite an extensive companion guide that is available for free on my website, and parents or young ladies or mentors can download it and print it out and have it available as some talking points, a way to get discussion going about what does it really mean to find your true love. And, you know, it's so confusing nowadays. The dating world has just become rather scary to a lot of young people. And our modern culture, particularly now with social media, has really changed the nature of dating. So, you know, cell phones and texting and Facebook and online dating services have really confused and made it a bigger kind of thing than maybe we had to deal with when we were first going through all of that. And so this companion guide can really offer some great ways to get the discussion flowing.
It is. And it's very generous of you to do it, and very generous of you to give it away like that. And I highly recommend, you know, that people, you know, parents and the readers get it, because it really helps to understand the story. Now, you know, Hemingway was a big on word counting. When he was writing, he would always every day count his words, and, you know, 516 one day and 480, and then when he'd hit 620, he'd think this was a really great day. And I know, are you the kind of person who counts your words every day? Do you try to set yourself a goal?
Oh, absolutely. I am just like that. As a matter of fact, I got up earlier this morning. I knew I was going to have a busy day, so I got going. I got my word count in here before, before coming on the radio with you. And yes, I do. I actually keep a daily log at the back of my notebook for the book that I'm working on, and I write down the date, how many words I've written, and then I tally it up, and I give myself a daily goal as well as a weekly challenge, so that if, for example, one day I fall a little bit short, if something happens, or, you know, life just, you know, you can't always predict what happens.
Yeah, with five kids and homeschooling them. Yeah. Now, I homeschooled my two boys, and I thought I did pretty well, you know, with two boys, but with five, that's a challenge. I bet things do pop up occasionally.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And it's just so busy. Life is busy taking the kids different places, especially as they've gotten older and need rides everywhere and are, you know, all going different directions with their activities and interests. It really is challenging to find time to write. But, you know, I feel like what's helped, as you said, is really sticking to a strict writing schedule. And I block out that writing time every day, and I really try not to let anything get in the way of that. But interruptions do happen, and so that's why I give myself the weekly goal as well. I can make up a little bit of writing one day that I missed on another. But my husband is also very, very supportive, and he pitches in to really help whenever possible. And we work together as a team to support each other.
Well, that's important.
Yeah.
That's important, especially, I think, especially when you're homeschooling and there's so many challenges that come with it. Now, you know, shades of Hemingway in your word count, but unlike Hemingway, who I cannot imagine doing Facebook or tweeting.
Yeah,
you are amazing. How did you become such an expert on this social media? Sort of every writer nowadays has to have a platform. That's what they tell.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to be a writer, if you're not going to have a platform, you're not going to get anywhere. But in your case, you have done an amazing job. Not only do you have a beautiful webpage, which is a dynamic webpage with things that move, things that are clickable, but you have an ongoing blog, and it's sort of a joint blog that you're doing with other people too. So I look at that and I think that's like a full-time job. I don't know how you manage it. And did you teach this to yourself?
Well, you know, early on, even before I got my first publishing contract, I just started getting online and kind of seeing what it would take to be a published author. I knew that I had taken a break from writing for a number of years while my kids were younger, and so when I came back, I had jumped into the internet age, and things were so different from when I was initially submitting and querying manuscripts. And so I really just felt like I needed to teach myself how to survive and how to thrive in the new industry. And so, yes, I really just did a lot of just reading other blogs, and agents had blogs, and I was reading and just trying to learn and kind of delved in. One of my passions is teaching. I really do love teaching not just my children but other people as well, and so I was able to kind of hone in on first making my blog about my journey to publication, just sharing what I was going through, my feelings, and it just seemed to draw a lot of interest, and I just kept going with that. And as I got an agent and my first contract, and I just kind of journaled all of what I was going through, and that just kept expounding and growing. And now, you know, I don't know, I think I've been blogging about 6 years or so, and so it's just continued to evolve out of that. And now I share a lot of what I've learned over the years, and particularly enjoy sharing about writing techniques and giving advice on, you know, one of my latest posts from this month was 10 ways writer moms can gain more writing time. And so I just shared 10 different tips of ways, particularly in the summer, when kids are home from school or really have a lot more free time, and how do moms still protect writing time and how do they keep that. And so just topics like that I share on my blog, and have really enjoyed that. But the blog obviously is just one part of a social media platform. And so over the years, I've also had to branch out into learning a lot about Facebook. Facebook and a lot about Twitter. And more in more recent years, I really enjoyed Pinterest. It's one of my favorite places. And learning to utilize Pinterest as a way to draw traffic to my blog. In fact, Pinterest is now one of the top sources of bringing traffic to my website. So learning how to do that and making graphics for it that go with blog posts and graphics for book giveaways and all of that has really helped. I'm also on Instagram because now being a YA writer, young adult writer, I know a lot of teens are on Instagram. So I'm just really trying to go to places where readers hang out and be available for them and enjoy chatting with them on those different sites. And it really hasn't been something that I feel is a hardship or an added burden because I really do enjoy all of it so much. But I will say that so that it doesn't consume my life, because it can be all-consuming, I have really learned to set boundaries and get my word count done, my writing done first, and then I use, you know, the leftover time, if I have any, to devote to social media. And, you know, I feel also that the climate has been changing in recent years about social media, and more emphasis is being put on marketing in other ways. And so, you know, really writers have to have that good balance of being visible, being present online for readers, but also keeping that main focus on their writing.
Well, one of the great things about being able to get online is that for somebody like you, you're doing historical works, you can do research. Isn't it wonderful?
Yes. Oh, it's absolutely incredible. Yes. I don't know how writers did it years ago, writing historical novels. It would be so much more challenging without the internet. But yes, I love it. Although I have to say, I also make extensive use of borrowing library books still. That is probably the foundation of my research, is finding specific books that relate to a particular time period, borrowing them through interlibrary loans, you know, getting them from all over the state, sometimes even from out of state, and having those as sort of my foundation. And that's also made easier to find those kind of books through the internet, because you see you might see an obscure title somewhere and think, oh, I wonder if I can get that book. And lo and behold, after some digging around, you finally can track it down through a library. But I also really appreciate, after I have that foundation of research, which usually takes me anywhere between 4 to 6 weeks of initial research before I'm starting writing. I spend all of that time looking at biographies, getting a feel for the time period, and really digging into the meat of what will comprise the plot of my book. But then once I get writing, issues always crop up. You just can't anticipate every single thing you're going to need to know before you start writing. So things do crop up, and you will change settings, and, you know, there will be issues that arise that you need to go and research. And that's when a quick internet research is really helpful, just to, you know, glean a little bit of information that you might need and pull it out and, you know, and be able to move on without having to stop entirely to do more research is so helpful. But a lot of times what I also do is, if I don't know something, I just highlight it. And I keep going.
Do your kids ever give you ideas for books? Are they good great readers?
Well, I do have a couple of really avid readers among my crew. they can't help, but we read all the time. We listen to a lot of audiobooks, and we have numerous bookshelves around the house that are just overflowing. So yes, we all really love to read. But two of mine are, I could see possibly branching into writing someday. They love it that much. But as far as ideas, at this point, they don't really give me too many ideas, but I did have one of my teen daughters read my young adult books in the early stages, and she was very helpful in giving me feedback on that and saying, "Mom, I knew who the bad guy was too early," or just stuff like that. And it was very helpful to get a teen perspective. And I actually pulled in a couple of other teens as well to get some feedback from. And so that was very encouraging. And so she's able to do that for me. All of them are all cheerleaders for me and really encourage me and keep me going. So, they do their part in their own way.
Well, I know my boys were reading at a very young age, but mm-hmm. being homeschooled, that's one of the wonderful things about being homeschooled. The children have so much more time to read because yes. in public schools, it's one thing after another. And that takes away from actually reading books. They're always into something else. And so I really was so happy that I homeschooled. And I know my boys had finished the Hardy Boys when they were five. It's wonderful. And one of the reasons I do this program is to encourage people to get their children to read, and as you're doing for writers to. Write young adult fiction, children's books. We all owe J.K. Rowling a big thank you for bringing so many kids to reading with Harry Potter.
Right.
And now we just have to keep it up. And great writers like you and other writers who are working in the field of young adult fiction, just to keep bringing books that the kids want to read so that they grow up all of their lives, because books will make their lives different, just expand their horizons so much.
Absolutely.
So I was so happy to when Zondervan contacted me with your book. They are mm-hmm. fantastic publishers, and one thing when you do get a book from them, it's going to be well done, and your book is so well done, and I think this is it's going to be part of a series, right?
Actually, it is.
Yes.
Right. There are the first book centers around there are three knights in the first book, and the three knights are vying to win the hand of this young maiden, and she she has to choose one of them and find true love by her 18th birthday, or she has to fulfill a vow that her parents took at her birth and go live in a convent.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so okay, well, she...
Okay, I'm running. Listen, I'm sorry. I'm running out of time, Jody. Just give your website.
Okay. It's Jody Hedlund. My full name, it's Jody Hedlund jodyhedlund.com.
Okay, yep. Everyone, mm-hmm. I will put that on my webpage and tell my people about it too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me. I hope
Thank
you'll come
you.
Back when your next book comes out, okay?
Thanks so much, Patsy.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Patsy with a Z.